Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, March 26. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth winds up his trip to Hawaii after meeting with top brass at the Indo-Pacific Command, as well as with local troops. A small group of protesters gathered outside the base yesterday afternoon. Some called on Hegseth to keep the commitment to clean up the Red Hill Underground Fuel Facility amidst news that the new head of EPA toured the area this weekend. We get an update on the latest for an alternate road in a high-risk wildfire area on the island of Hawaii. And an NPR journalist weighs in on national issues. What's the role of journalism at a time like this? And we learn about the latest effort to enhance our reefs, one patch at a time. We take you inside a coral nursery where restoration efforts are making great progress. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As Pete Hegseth makes his first visit to the Pacific region as Secretary of Defense, we also learn of another Trump official who paid a visit to Hawaii. Lee Zeldin, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, toured the Maui Burn Zone and the Red Hill Underground Fuel Storage Facility this past weekend. Zeldin very quietly slipped in and out of town, touring the area and meeting briefly with state health officials. It is a Hegseth's visit that has grabbed the headlines, though, as he touched down Monday amidst Signalgate, a controversy over the use of the encrypted messaging app to discuss sensitive war plans in Yemen with high-level appointees, and while unknowingly including an editor from The Atlantic on the chain. That breach of security protocol overshadowed the EPA visit. But various groups, an anti-military organization, and environmental advocates like the Oahu Water Protectors, used the visit to demonstrate at the gates of Pacific Fleet Command yesterday afternoon. We talked to Heolani Sonoda-Pale, who sits on the CRI, the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative, formed after the fuel spill that contaminated the Navy's drinking water system.
We were there to ensure, you know, the new Secretary of Defense doesn't forget about Red Hill and that there's still a lot of cleanup that needs to be done. And also there was a DMIL group, which, of course, was all about getting the military out of Hawaii, and then one group asking for his resignation. So there was definitely a mix of groups, and so there was a good number of people out there yesterday at the sign waving. I believe he did exit the facility in the early part of the event, but we can't confirm that, but we believe he did pass by. So, you know, it was a quiet event. It wasn't, you know, anything rowdy or anything. It was just
not disruptive.
Very much, yeah. It was just people just trying to get their perspectives out there that this... There's real problems when you got three different groups coming out there and sign waving when there's a new Secretary of Defense. It was a real range of people. It wasn't just your usual activist or DMIL advocate. It was just like regular people out there asking for his resignation as well.
Well, we all know Red Hill has been a flashpoint, given what happened with the spill and the contamination of the drinking water and the fact that it threatens our drinking water aquifer for all of us here on the island and not just those on the Navy system that were initially affected. But a big point in the Red Hill facility is the remediation.
Yeah, so we have a bill that is almost at the end going through the legislature. House Bill 505, which is called the VI Act. But what's happening now is that there's a real silence about what's going on. So the last, I'm a member of the Red Hill CRI, so I represent Native Hawaiian interests. But the last meeting that the U.S. Navy and the Defense Logistics Agency attended was back in March of 2024. Since then, we haven't gotten much communication from them except, you know, we were told to go to these open houses, but there's no real communication in terms of, like, you know, what are the water tests saying? what's happening with the different wells. And now we're finding out that they're planning to open up the three wells that were shut down, the Red Hill well and the Aiea Halava shaft. And the Aiea Halava shaft, we just found out about that last week. But that had a conditional approval from the Department of Health back in February. Like, I believe it was like February 7th, 2025. So the Department of Health is going through the process of allowing the Navy to reopen the Halava Waiava shaft. And there's problems with that. Number one, no one else was told. Not even the Board of Water Supply knew about this. We sent them the memo that we finally got from the Department of Health. Second of all, the tests for those shafts aren't made public. So we don't even know what's in the water in the Aiea Halava shafts. It's not on the Safe Water website where they're putting all the tests as part of the long-term monitoring plan. And now we're in the extended monitoring plan. Now, the long-term monitoring of the water in terms of the Navy testing the wells to see where, you know, where the contamination is gone, that ends this month. That's another issue. So there's nothing holding them back from, like, not doing any more tests and not giving us any more information.
So you're concerned about the regulators and just transparency and just getting more information?
Just getting more information, yeah. And it's going to be very vital, because if they're planning to open those wells, the Red Hill and Aiea Halava shaft, and we don't even know what's in the water, then that is a real problem.
We just learned through the military's DBID's website that the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency paid a visit to the Red Hill facility over the weekend. It was a very quiet visit, but at least he got to see firsthand the magnitude of that facility. What are your hopes now that he has come to look at this situation?
I hope they'll do the right thing. That explains a lot, because the Red Hill CRI members, we got an email on Monday morning from the EPA saying that they're going to start up meetings between us, the EPA, and the Navy. And one of the things we need to do in order to facilitate this meeting happening is to sign a agreement beforehand saying we will follow the ground rules that they set, which is what the Navy and the EPA set. They know that this needs to happen. So that's a good thing. My concern is that it's moving too slow, and they're moving to reopen the wells, and that is a real danger to public health.
Apparently, the White House has indicated that they intend to cut the roles of the EPA by about 1,000 people, you know, mainly scientists and chemists. I don't know. You concerned about that?
Definitely. I do know that the new head is very in support of Trump's agenda, of course, right, which does not prioritize environmental justice or environmental protections. That is an actual huge concern. We thought we were dead in the water until we got that email on Monday. So I think we are going to have to, like, navigate this next few years with a whole new administration very carefully, because our future here on Oahu really depends on how well we navigate this new administration. And the bottom line is all of us need clean water coming out of our faucets. So this is going to be very challenging, a very challenging next 4 years working with the EPA and remediating the contamination from Red Hill.
That was Heilani Sonodopale, who's a member of the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative, sharing her thoughts about the message that they wanted Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to hear. Hegseth concluded his visit to Hawaii this morning. He's now off to Guam, which will be followed by a visit to the Philippines and Japan. And we also talked to Sierra Club Hawaii's Executive Director Wayne Tanaka. He was encouraged to learn that EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin paid a visit to the Red Hill fuel site and the Maui burn zone this weekend.
I'm glad that Zeldin at least stopped by and maybe, you know, witnessed the enormous challenges that we're facing in Lahaina, in Red Hill, you know, especially as an isolated island chain with such limited lands and resources. That being said, you know, the actions of the larger EPA, you know, continue to be a source of major, I think, concern with environmental groups. And I think, you know, really for anyone who is interested in clean air and lands and waters.
Well, there was this announcement last week that the administration plans to cut its scientific staff for the EPA. And I know that, you know, the state has relied on that knowledge to help as a regulator, particularly in a situation like Red Hill, which is just a massive project.
Absolutely. You know, both the, I think the release of staff who are needed to carry out the EPA's mission, as well as the rollback of legal protections for our, you know, our lands, our waters, our air, you know, those are all things that are, I think, should be sources of major concern. You know, environmental protection really should not be a partisan issue, right? You know, toxic chemicals, you know, drinking water, it's not going to care what your political ideology is. The cancers, you know, you can get from PCBs or trichloroethylenes, you know, that we and that our children may be increasingly exposed to with these rollbacks and these staff cuts. Those cancers don't care if you're MAGA or if you're woke. And even if, thinking of the Department of Defense, you know, even under their vision of national security, you know, as Red Hill amply illustrated, you can't run a Navy base if your sailors are sick or if they're worried about, you know, their families getting poisoned. And that's not to mention the larger security impacts of the climate crisis and the greenhouse gas-induced extreme weather events that we're going to be increasingly seeing. I'm hoping that the cleanup of Red Hill is not seen as, you know, a partisan issue or it becomes part of the collateral damage in these political conflicts that we've been experiencing. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect any entity to clean up a mess that it's made. And I think that's an expectation that we should continue to maintain, that we should continue to voice to our leaders in government, whose duty is to really protect the people and the environment upon which we rely.
And this week, the Secretary of Defense is visiting Honolulu. He's getting his first visit, I think, to the Indo-Pacific Command in the region. But, you know, a lot of the security and defense issues are tied to bases. And, you know, some of the military lands, the leases are up and, you know, are tied to cleanup as well of their installations.
Right. Yes. Again, I think, you know, the military has long expressed a desire or commitment to being, you know, good stewards, good tenants. You know, that obviously hasn't always been the case. I think, again, regardless of who our leaders are in the federal government, we as the people of Hawaii need to, you know, take it upon ourselves to ensure that we keep raising that issue and keep maintaining our very reasonable expectation that whether it's the military, whether it's a private corporation, that, you know, that entities that make a mess of our environment are held accountable to that and do what's necessary to, you know, heal the harms that have been inflicted on the islands.
That was Sierra Club Hawaii's chapter director Wayne Tanaka talking to us about the visit of EPA head Lee Zeldin to the Red Hill Fuel Storage Facility and the Maui Burn Zone this past weekend. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Honolulu's downtown is a true skyline, a cityscape full of mirrored glass and concrete towering over the streets below. But once upon a time, Honolulu was a small town situated around the harbor before the 1960s construction boom, when it was said the crane was the state bird. Most buildings rose only two or three stories high. When the 10-story Aloha Tower was completed in 1926, it became the tallest building in town. As the skyline has evolved, so have the streets surrounding the giant corporate centers and condos. Alakea Street in Honolulu's business district was once a towpath from Honolulu Harbor. If you took a trip into the city's past, you'd see mules pulling ships over the harbor sandbar. The mules labored over a surface that was neither asphalt nor dirt. For today's backyard quiz, can you name the material that once formed this towpath? The Hawaiian to English translation of the compound word formed from the meanings of ala and kea would give you a hint in answering today's question. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing solutions for homeless residents living on the island of Maui, such as Home Aid Hawaii. NareitHawaii.com.
It's time for Europe to rearm itself. That's the opinion of leaders like EU Chief Ursula von der Leyen. Other experts know it's not going to be easy.
I think Europe is not prepared in any shape or form, despite the will and despite the rhetoric. It will take a lot of time.
The push to prepare Europe for war, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
Following the Maui wildfires, evacuation routes have become a priority for many communities. Here to give us an update on the situation in Waikoloa is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what's the latest?
So Waikoloa Village is extremely vulnerable to wildfires, and residents want another evacuation route, specifically one that connects the very back of this village, which is home to about 7,500 people, to the main highway below. And this issue animated a recent town hall hosted by new Hawaii County Mayor Kimo Alameda. You can take a listen to this exchange he had.
I hear you one time, that's good for me. Okay, you're not gonna tell me 10 times. I know it's an issue, I'm just saying. I don't know how you guys was raised, but if your parents talk 2, 3 times, 4 times, they would be mad already. So I got the shirt too, I was gonna bring my second road shirt today. So I hear you, I know it's important. I know it's important. I know it's your lives. What kind of answer you let me give you than the one I already gave?
The highest priority.
It is the highest priority.
So at this meeting, there was not one but two petitions circling, calling for a second road, another evacuation route. And as you can hear in that clip, Alameda is getting a lot of comments and questions from community residents about when they will have another evacuation route. And the woman that you hear responding to Kimo Alameda, the one saying, it's our lives, the highest priority, that's Stephanie Mines. She's affiliated with the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa, and they work on a lot of issues related to wildfire, but getting another two-lane evacuation route out of the village is their top issue.
And so was there, what, some kind of groundbreaking for this route?
So there was a groundbreaking last May for another road out of the back of the village, and Mayor Mitch Roth's administration had worked out this handshake deal with the development company Summers West, which is owned by Charles Summers, to build a road that would connect Kamakua Drive down to Queen Ka'ohumanu Highway. And Charles Summers owned some of the land. He was going to pay for the entirety of the road. What the Roth administration did was get together the other landowners to agree to have this road be open through their land so that people could evacuate in the case of a disaster. And there was some fanfare. The governor came out, as did Ed Sniffen, the director of the Hawaii Department of Transportation. And it was this hopeful moment for residents that their concerns were being heard. And not just that, Bob Yonke, who's Mine's husband and also involved with the Wildfire Safety Advocates of Waikoloa, says there was a commitment from the Roth administration that this evacuation route would be done in 2025. I spoke with Bob at that same town hall meeting hosted by Mayor Alameda.
We were promised last year when the governor came and Ed Sniffen, the director of Hawaii Transportation, and the then mayor, Mitch Roth, that this emergency road, which is not a new highway, it's not the full highway, but it's a way out in case of emergency, would be available by this summer before we get to the peak fire season.
Yeah, we all understand, you know, an alternate route could be a lifesaver in the event of a disaster like we saw with Maui.
Absolutely. Now, I spoke with former Mayor Mitch Roth, who disputes that there was an explicit commitment as to when the road would be done, as does Representative David Tarnas, who represents Waikoloa and was also at that groundbreaking. According to Roth, since the county is not paying for this road, the developer is, their agreement did not set a deadline. But Roth says that based on where things were when he left office, he thinks it's feasible the road could be usable in 2025.
It could be ready this year. My understanding is it is right now drivable from point to point, but it's not in the condition that they were looking at for an emergency access road.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, if the county isn't going to condemn the land and, you know, pave it and make it just an alternate access road, then, yeah, you've got to think about what can get worked out here. I mean, I'm thinking of, like, you know, Oahu's west side where the military is opening up access in the event of a disaster. They provide the community a way out. So, you know, you can see if it's an emergency route, it doesn't have to be a fully perfect road.
Right. And Ross says he started working on trying to figure out a solution after he called an evacuation for Waikoloa in 2021 and people got stuck on the main road that they have out of there for, in some instances, over an hour. So he approached different developers in the area and said, how can we come together to find a solution that benefits everyone? The developers in some of their contracts, including Summers West, say they have to have a road at some point when they have that many a certain number of houses, and at that point, the county would perhaps take some ownership of it. But first, how can we just have a way that people can drive out of in case of a disaster? So that's at the heart of this informal agreement. But Alameda's administration has been casting doubt on the nature of this agreement and the feasibility of getting this road open. Both in the town hall that I went to last week and in a follow-up interview that I had with him, he said he wasn't sure exactly the nature of this agreement Roth made with the developers.
The prior administration had made it seem like the ball was rolling in the direction of completing that project. But in our campaign, I've stated to the prior administration that the not all of the lot owners were completely aware that a road would be going through their backyard. And two lot owners in particular were the lot owners closest to Queen K on the bottom, right? And so, you know, so that's why I felt that the prior administration, when they had the groundbreaking and they brought the governor in, I thought that was very political. It was right before election, and it wasn't done correctly. So I just thought that what I was trying to share with the people from Waikoloa is that, you know, you've been misled.
So Alameda says he's following up with the liaison for the private developer in the project in order to get more details about its status, and he is supportive of Waikoloa getting another evacuation route. But he told me it would be, quote, really nice if we could complete it within my 4-year term, which is a much different timeline than what people like Bob Yonke were hoping for.
Do we know any more about the communications with the developer and the county?
So Kimo Alameda said that he has a meeting with a developer in order to get into the details of this agreement. And I spoke to the Roth administration and asked what communication happened between your administration and the Alameda administration about this project in the handoff. And he, by the way, he disagrees with the idea that he misled the public about the work or feasibility of this project. Here's what he had to say.
I don't know how much conversation he had with the planning department, with the public works department prior to becoming mayor, but we made it abundantly clear that, you know, we were available to have communication. And unfortunately for me and Kimo, and you know, nothing, I have no ill feelings toward him, but I know when you're taking over a new administration, there's a lot of work. I've made myself available, and even to this day, if he has any questions or anything like that, I'm always happy to go sit down and talk to him. But not much, you know, there wasn't a lot of communication after the election.
You know, and I know, you know, usually when there is a switch of administrations that, you know, there is a, you know, some delay as the new mayor and his cabinet, you know, get up to speed. You can see how this could fall through the cracks.
Yes, and there's also new leadership in Alameda's administration in certain departments, including, I believe, the Department of Public Works. And the developers, when I was reporting this story, Summers West, really are the missing piece of this puzzle. I'm working to get clarity from them on the status of the road. But I think some of the frustration from residents that I've spoken to in Waikoloa is it seems like communication, as you said, fell through the cracks in this handover, and they aren't able to get clear answers from the Alameda administration right now about when they might have access to this road. And some residents really do feel it is their lives that are on the line.
Yeah, well, I'm sure, yeah, other communities would feel the same way, too, if they were in a high-risk area. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been talking to HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater, presenting five Iranian films, including Shada, Persepolis, and The Persian Version, on now. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were once independent mortgage finance companies. Then came the 2008 housing crash and a government takeover. Now, the Trump administration wants to privatize them.
So I'm really concerned about execution, and then I'm worried about, are we protecting people from being exploited?
How to get the government out of the mortgage business. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
The CEOs of NPR and PBS testified before a House subcommittee on government efficiency this morning. It was to question whether public broadcasting should receive federal funding. The hearing was heated from the start, with Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene calling the two public media organizations radical left-wing echo chambers. The Conversation's Maddie Bender woke up bright and early to talk with Mary Louise Kelly ahead of the hearing. Kelly is the co-host of All Things Considered, and her memoir is to be released in paperback on April 8th. Kelly discussed holding powerful people accountable and the role of facts and opinions in the newsroom.
Hi, Maddie. This is Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. How are you this very early morning for you?
Aloha. I am doing well. I didn't think that I would have kind of a visceral reaction to hearing your voice, but very much did. And it puts you exactly in the hour. So I hope that our listeners aren't too confused when we air this at 11 a.m. our time.
Well, exactly. I know Robert Siegel, my predecessor in the exact chair at All Things Considered that I occupy, I know every once in a while when he would have some kind of interview or story that would end up on Morning Edition, half the country would be writing in. They were so confused at hearing Robert Siegel in the air at 7 in the morning. Just was not comprehensible. So hopefully people will survive.
Well, I greatly appreciate you taking the time. And I did want to start also by saying that in your book, the way that you describe running a daily news and interview show is highly relatable, just with the ephemerality of it, of you can do the best story in the world, and the second the show wraps, it's on to the next day. So I'm wondering from you how you manage to hold on to some of the bigger moments and really end up grounding yourself in the day-to-day.
Well, it's so true. The blessing and the curse of hosting a daily evening news program is that, yeah, you no matter what you write, how beautiful it is, how glorious it is, the greatest interview you'll ever do, you wake up and it's a clean slate the next day and you have to do the whole darn thing over again. As I say, that is, it's frustrating sometimes when you've poured your heart and soul into a story and then the whole news cycle moves on. But it's also a quite lovely thing. It's one of my favorite moments of my day. Every day is the 9:30 a.m. Eastern, all things considered, editorial meeting where the whole team, you know, from senior hosts and executive producer to, you know, the new intern are all gathered at a conference room table. And these days, some people are joining from all over via Zoom and pitching, what are the stories you want to cover? And we really live up to the all things considered name. So people are pitching stuff all over the map. And I love it because at that time of day, anything is possible. No one's turned us down yet. And every day I come in and think, what am I curious about? What are my questions? Who could answer them? Let's get them on the phone. It's so much fun. The flip is writing a book like It Goes So Fast, which was an attempt to like put a pin in one particular year because it does go so fast. And I look back on, I was writing this in real time now a couple of years ago. And as I look back, I think, gosh, I've already forgotten some of these details. I'm so glad I put them down on a page. I've already forgotten exactly how that conversation unfolded or quite how funny it was in the moment. And it makes me realize it's the advice you always get about, you know, take a photograph, not just of, you know, the big smiling people formally posed at a ceremony or a birthday or whatever, but like of the little things, you know, of your kids, you know, sprawled on the floor doing their homework. Like that's the stuff that I miss. And that's the kind of thing that I was trying to capture in this book. Let me just take this 1 year and sit with it.
Yeah. And you write about reckoning with your own choices while still living them, which I think personally is really profound. I wanted to talk about the context. I mean, the time we're living in, but then today, you know, this hearing, NPR and PBS, the heads of them are talking in front of Congress. And there's been a lot made about impartiality in the media. And at the same time, you have projects like yours, or I think about Wildcard with Rachel Martin.
A great show. Yes, highly recommend.
And the rise of, I guess, opinions, but then possibly a distinction between that and an ideological bent. I wonder what you think about that distinction and what the role of voice, if not ideological bent, has in the newsroom.
I think it's always been important. And if anything, I feel more committed to the mission now than when I was starting out in this business. I look at the news media today, we face all kinds of challenges. We face challenges to do with funding. We face challenges to do with, as you noted, you know, they were watching as you and I speak, CEO of NPR, who's testifying on Capitol Hill today. One of the things I love about working at NPR is that we will cover ourselves and this debate as we would any other story. That is firewalled from our PR team or the big corporate bosses. We're not a corporation, but you know, the leaders of NPR will have no input into the journalism that's being conducted in the newsroom on this story, and that's a great thing. I think what I can do in this moment is continue to ask questions in the service of finding out what decisions are being made and why, and holding people in positions of power to account. That's what we do. And to your question about the role of opinion, I hats off to my colleagues in the media who write brilliant opinionated op-eds and go on cable news and do analysis. That's important work. I'm glad they're doing it. It's not what I choose to do because I think, if anything, the value of old bootstrap reporting is elevated in this moment. We are trying to operate with facts in a fact-based reality. And there is huge value in journalists going out into our country, into our communities, and out in the world and sharing with our audience what we see, what we hear, what it looks like. And then people can make up their own minds what they want to think about it. That kind of journalism is expensive. It costs money to send our correspondents out into the world. It costs money to send me and my team out to report stories. And NPR continues to do that on a tight nonprofit public radio budget because we believe in that and the value that it brings to people who are in our audience listening and reading our work.
Yeah. And maybe I could have phrased some of that question better, because as someone who runs an interview show, I do actually feel like there is some opinion involved in choosing which voices to elevate and which guests to book, even if at the end of the day, what I'm doing is that shoe leather reporting.
Well, and absolutely. And I, these are discussions that we have in our newsroom all the time. What voices are we booking? Who do we want to hear from? What's the range of voices that we put on air? Part of the job of hosting a program like All Things Considered is we're going to put all kinds of voices with all kinds of views. I don't feel any obligation to balance truth with lies, but I do feel an obligation to put people with a range of views. And people who are in positions of power, who are making decisions that impact our country in real time, to ask them respectful but tough questions about why they think what they think, why they're doing what they do, how that squares with the facts. And then again, people can make up their own mind what they want to think of the people I or you are interviewing.
On that topic of holding sources accountable, holding truth to power, you write about your interview with Mike Pompeo in the book. I think many are also having another moment of seemingly alternative facts right now with the recent story that broke, Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic being added to a group chat seemingly with leaders of this nation. And I just want to know, what does some of the preparation for the interviews you conduct look like when you have a fair chance of having to fact check in real time?
Yeah, some of my preparation is very basic, is just sitting and thinking, what do I really want to know that this particular person can answer? And if you go into interview, say, the Secretary of State, there's a million things you want to ask about a million different parts of the world and their aspects of their work. You're going to get to, you know, in 10, 15 minutes, you're going to get to like two or three. And I try to think of the more complex a subject, the more basic my questions should probably be. And so it starts with, what do I actually want to know? How can I frame a question that will elicit an answer to that? Part of my prep is, it's every interview I do is building on the last, and it helps enormously. So you mentioned the Mike Pompeo interview, then Secretary of State in President Trump's first term. The two things I wanted to question him about in that interview were Iran and Ukraine. And it was very helpful that right, you know, a couple of weeks before I sat down and interviewed him, I had been in Iran. And so I had interviewed his counterpart, the then foreign minister of Iran. I had interviewed ordinary people out and about in the streets and markets and restaurants in Iran. And that helps enormously in preparing for an interview here in Washington to say, I've been out, I've seen that part of the world. Here's what I'm hearing. How do you respond to that? That's the kind of preparation that I do. And partly it's just, you don't think too hard about the kind of, I don't think too hard about what the agenda going is. I'm not trying to ask gotcha questions. I'm just trying to ask a question or two that will advance our audience's knowledge of U.S. foreign policy. That's what you do when you go to interview the Secretary of State. And that remains the mission the next time I get the chance to do it.
Mary Louise Kelly, All Things Considered host and author of It Goes So Fast. Thank you so much for taking the time.
It has been a pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
That was NPR host Mary Louise Kelly talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Kelly's book is set to be released in paperback next week. Full disclosure, HPR receives federal funding from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. Learn more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you help shine the spotlight on Hawaii's next generation of musicians.
How long have you been playing the violin?
I've been playing for about 7 years. I got my violin for Christmas when I was 6, and then I started playing probably a month after.
Hear from local students every Tuesday on HPR2's Classical Pacific.
I'd say just number one thing for really any musician, but even percussionists too, it's really just all about persistence and exactness. There will be times where, you know, you kind of get down about it, but there's always a light around the corner.
Help HPR uplift Hawaii's youngest musicians. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
And now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we looked back at vintage Honolulu to a time before Hawaii's capital became the glass and concrete jungle that we know today. Downtown's Alakea Street was originally a towpath from the harbor. The mules that pull the ships into mooring bays are long gone, and so too is the trail leading from the water into the bustling center of harbor life. Before it was paved in asphalt, the road for mules was covered with a different material, and today we asked you to name it. If you know the language or picked up a Hawaiian dictionary, you know ala means pathway and kea means white. And what could create that pathway? A homegrown gravel, white coral. That's today's Backyard Quiz, with thanks to Tutu Sally for today's quiz. And thanks to our winner, Arthur Park of Makiki. You got it right. So nice to learn that you called us, Arthur. Hope to see you soon. Well, that's our quiz. If you have an idea for one, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from HMSA, for over 85 years providing health plans to the people of Hawaii with a commitment to supporting the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Brian Bailey has been elected sheriff 4 times in a row.
I see right and wrong. I see criminals and I see law-abiding citizens.
But under his watch, serious allegations started to come out about some deputies.
I had my legs pinned down and he chased me again. Bang! I said, oh, whoa, whoa, no. I'm trying to tell them what they wanted to hear.
A reign of terror in Rankin County, Mississippi. On the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Inside a facility at Sand Island, workers at the State Land and Natural Resources Department are nurturing all kinds of marine life, from sea urchins to coral colonies. It's an effort to help and restore, enhance our reefs. We got an opportunity to visit a coral nursery at the Division of Aquatic Resources to see what goes into growing coral. DAR is asking the public to determine which next patch of reef will get some extra TLC to help the marine environment flourish. Stepping into the laboratory, it looks like a bakery. Glass shelves displaying what looks like pyramid-shaped desserts decorated with, toasted miniature marshmallows or peanut brittle. Only they are coral structures that will soon be outplanted on the south and east side of Oahu. We talked to Christina Jane, coral nursery curator at the facility, about the work underway and a series of meetings that kicks off this week.
So our whole goal is to take small corals, grow them up bigger and faster than they would grow naturally, and then plant these individual coral colonies out onto reefs that have been damaged or degraded.
Okay, and we have these little pyramid structures that are varying sizes. What's the best size, I guess, for deploying them out on the reef?
So we have 2 primary sizes of corals that we're outplanting. Our main size is about a 16-inch coral colony. And we have another size that's slightly smaller. So for this project, it will be a mix of both of those sizes.
And so tell us, where are the locations that you're looking at and why do you need public input?
It's a great question. We're looking at four different potential sites. We have two pairs. So Waikiki, we're looking at Waikiki in the MLCD, the Marine Life Conservation District, and Turtle Canyons. And then we're also looking at Kewalo by Kewalo Pipe and Mauna Loa Bay, kind of offshore of the Hoiloa Ridge area.
And so are you looking for input from people who frequent these areas?
Yes. We are looking for input that people can share about why we want to choose these priority sites for restoration, and of the two pairs of sites, which one should our priority to be first? So we're looking for people who live in these areas, who work in these areas, who go out to these sites all the time. That's input is going to be really valuable for us.
What is the intent of enhancing the coral in these areas?
Our coral reefs are really, really important for our ocean ecosystem, especially here in Hawaii. So we're looking at these sites as both a restoration and enhancement effort, and also sites that people go to, so we can use that as an educational part of the project where both residents and visitors can see restoration in action and they can learn more about the importance of our coral reefs.
So some of us who maybe swim and snorkel in these locations are worried though that then it could be overrun. You know, it's like, be careful what you wish for, because if you declare a marine conservation district, it might be then it becomes a huge draw and then you almost defeat the purpose, right? Because you've got to worry about access, like on the North Shore, right? That's open and it's not like Hanama Bay where you control the ingress and egress of crowds. And so when you have, you know, fishermen that can go in these areas, right? There's a little conflict there, tension.
That's a great question. That's why in looking at these sites, we're looking at sites that are existing recreation areas, sites that people already go to. So we're not creating a new site, you know, we're not creating a new scuba dive site. We're looking at restoring and enhancing existing sites.
Tell us about then the opportunity that the public will have to learn about this project and how they can give input.
So there's three meetings that we have. If you would like to come and participate and learn more about the project, we'd really love to hear from the people that use these areas. So we have our in-person meeting, which is at the Waikiki Aquarium on Thursday, March 27th at 5:30 to 7 p.m. And then we also have two Zoom meetings, April 1st at noon to 1:30 p.m. and April 9th at 5:30 to 7 p.m. And you can learn all about the meetings and more about the project on our website as well. Probably the easiest way to find that is just to Google DAR Oahu Coral Outplanting Project. There's also a survey if you either don't want to attend a meeting or you just want to share your input. There's an online survey that you can find on our website.
And then as far as choosing these sites in Waikiki or on the east side, why this area versus, let's say, North Shore or Windward Oahu?
I would say there's areas across the island that need restoration. And so based off of our surveys and support that we have, we've identified these sites as a priority, but we've conducted coral restoration across the island.
Okay, so this isn't something new to you, but you just want to figure out, is there a better way to engage the public, raise the awareness, and maybe just the appreciation of the work that you're doing here?
Yes, that's exactly what we want. We've outplanted across Oahu, and since 2019, we have about 90% success rate of all the corals that we've outplanted. So we're looking to expand the project and include the community.
And talk about the types of coral that you'll be outplanting.
We have several different types of coral. So we'll go out and survey to see what types of coral are there, and we'll target those species for restoration. So we have corals like rice coral, we have lobe coral, and antler coral are just some of the species that we work with.
Talk about how the coral pyramids that you have in here grow at a much faster rate under these controlled conditions versus, let's say, out in the field.
So the coral pyramids that we have here, the final product, for example, of our 16-inch corals, that coral naturally in the wild would be 20 to 25 years old, and we're growing them in 1 to 2 years. So we're drastically speeding up the growth rate so that we can plant these corals out on the reef and contribute to the habitat and contribute to the restoration of our coral reef ecosystems.
So when you outplant these things, you are going to, what, cement them onto the reef?
Corals are growing on a foundation that's a concrete pyramid. And so underneath, there's no living coral tissue. And so we can use special epoxy that's safe to use in the ocean and safe to use in aquariums, and use that to secure them onto the existing reef substrate.
Okay, so they get anchored on the natural reef, and then you put up little signs saying, you know, be careful, this is a work in progress.
Well, the corals will continue to grow down onto the reef. And right now we're hoping to work with other agencies and partners to come up with the best way to educate people about these sites. So we may not do an underwater sign. We may do something where we have materials that can be given to residents and visitors to educate them more about these sites.
I look at these things and it reminds me of like brittle, you know, candy or little cakes that are decorated. I mean, they're pretty cool looking.
Yeah, they are really cool. And over time, as they continue to grow, they start off as these pyramids, but they'll eventually keep growing in the environment. And some of them might have little branches that start to grow. And so they might look like a pyramid with, you know, these little hands sticking out, the branches of the coral. Some of them will get more lumpy, so they'll be that's the natural growth form of the coral. So it's really exciting to see them grow.
And has there been anywhere else that we can point to where you've used this type of thing? If not here in Hawaii, then, you know, some other location across the world?
So this we've developed specifically for Hawaii, and that is because our corals and our reefs are incredibly unique and very, very different from pretty much every other reef ecosystem in the world. So we had to develop this technique specifically for Hawaii.
Okay, and any trick to the pyramid's shape?
Yeah, we selected the pyramid shape after a lot of testing, and where we looked at what was the best shape for these corals. We started off with a dome shape, but we ultimately settled on the pyramid shape because it's a 3D structure that mimics a natural growth form of the coral. It's a pyramid, so if dirt lands, sediment lands on top of it, it can naturally kind of fall off from gravity. And it works really well in an environment that has waves and surge.
So I guess, yeah, trial and error, and then we'll just see how it goes.
Yeah, well, we've had really great success so far, so we're really excited about expanding our coral restoration efforts, and we're really looking forward to getting input from everyone who uses these areas to choose our priority sites.
That was Coral Nursery Curator Christina Jane talking to us about the coral restoration efforts underway. The public is being asked to weigh in on the selection of 2 sites out of 4 to target. One set of options is the Turtle Cleaning Station off Fort DeRussy Beach at one end of Waikiki or behind the Waikiki Aquarium in the Marine Conservation District off Kapi'olani Park. The other choice is between Kiwalo and Mauna Loa just off of Hawakui Beach Park. The first meeting is at the Waikiki Aquarium classrooms tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Two other meetings will be held in April. Look for links on our website. Work is expected to begin later this summer and take about a year to complete. Well, we have to go now. But up tomorrow, we will be taking a look at evacuation plans of her community in the event of a disaster. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.